Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to the Children's Justice Project monthly training series. This training is offered to key stakeholders involved in Wyoming's juvenile court system and held every second Tuesday of the month from 12 to 1 p.m. To obtain the materials electronically for today's training, please visit the Children's Justice Project website at www.courts.state.wy.us/initiatives/CJP and then click the training tab in the middle of the screen. If there are any questions, participants are welcome to call in during the last 10 minutes of the training session. The call-in number is area code 917-889-8064. One may also post questions and comments using the online chat session on the Blog Talk Radio website. We hope you'll find today's training informative and would like to thank you for your attendance.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everybody. This is Ann Reiniger from the Supreme Court Children's Justice Project, and I welcome you to our monthly webinar. Today's topic is Comprehensive Overview of Wyoming Juvenile Court Rules and Relevant Supreme Court Decisions. And what you will know at the end of our program today are the 10 rules of procedure for juvenile courts with a special emphasis on discovery, the Wyoming Supreme Court decisions on these rules, and how these rules relate to practices in different jurisdictions, along with lots of other good things. The rules are located on the CJP website, and so you can just click that on if you haven't already. There'll be 50 minutes of presentation with 10 minutes of questions and answers afterwards. You can either put it on the chat line or call in directly to the number that was provided at the beginning of this session. Our speakers today are Jill Kachera, who is a Senior Assistant Attorney General at the Human Services Division at our Wyoming Attorney General's Office, and Elizabeth Lance, who is an attorney with the Wyoming Guardian Ad Litem Program. And without further ado, I'm pleased to introduce Jill and Beth.
Thank you, Ann. The joint thing there. So Beth and I are kind of going to go back and forth in talking about these rules. The rules have been in place almost 10 years. They became effective on July 1st of 2007. And so hopefully everybody who's listening and practices in the area of juvenile court is somewhat familiar with them. We are just going to take each rule and talk a little bit about each one. There are 10 rules. And then there are a couple of cases that have come out from the Wyoming Supreme Court, one in 2009 and one in 2013, that address the rules. And Beth will talk about one of those cases, and I will talk about the other. And we certainly hope that once we get done with our presentation, because there are a lot of jurisdictions out there, and each may have their own unique approach to the rules, that people will provide comments if they have some additional information or some disagreement with how we are looking at the rules. And Beth also, because she is in a unique position in that she has played, I think, all of the roles that would be pertinent in juvenile court, in that she has been a prosecutor, she has been a parent's attorney and a public defender for youth in CHINs and delinquency cases, and she also now is doing GAL work. And as you will notice on one of the cases that we talk about, she was formerly at the Attorney General's office and actually did the briefing and argument on one of the cases. So I think Beth is going to provide much more pertinent information than maybe I will in this matter. So without further ado, with respect to Rule 1, that is the title and scope of the rules, The rules apply to all juvenile court actions, so child protection actions, CHINs, child in need of supervision actions, and delinquency actions. And then that particular rule provides a little bit of definition, but basically just defining who the state is and who the respondents are in those juvenile proceedings. And finally, references the rules of evidence. But again, if you look at Wyoming Rule of Evidence 1101B3, it does limit the application of the Wyoming Rules of Evidence in these juvenile proceedings. So that's something to be aware of. And when you're looking at these rules, also take a look at that rule. With respect to Rule 2, it's kind of divided in four sections, and I'm going to let Beth talk about Rule 2A, the presence of the child, as that is something that she deals with on a regular basis.
Yeah, so if we look at Rule 2A, it has interesting language here. Let me back up. So the way this reads is that a child who is not of suitable age to understand or participate in the proceedings need not be present at hearings in abuse and neglect actions unless the court so orders. That's kind of an interesting rule to me from a guardian ad litem perspective. Guardian ad litems are generally taught that it is best practice to include the children in the process affecting their lives as much as possible. And that would include bringing children to court if that is their desire to be part of that process and to see what is happening in court. So this can become, sometimes difficult. There could be some differences then under this with the guardian ad litem's opinion as to the suitability of the age or the suitability of the child to be at certain hearings and things of that nature. So it is a rule where I could see there being some controversy occasionally. I had a case last week where I had children present in the courtroom who were some as young as 5, and so they were very young, but they had a great desire to be present, and so they were allowed to be there. However, I felt that the court, after the hearing, felt that maybe it wasn't appropriate for them to attend again. And so this is something where there could be some controversy between a guardian ad litem, I think, specifically as the attorney for the children and wanting to have that best practice of having children present that want to be present. However, I will say typically what I see in practice is that it is usually just teenage children that end up coming to court when it is an abuse or neglect action. However, there are occasions where I have seen or I have taken younger children into court. So this need not be present is an interesting language to me. It has not been interpreted by the Supreme Court, and so I don't know that I can say that it's any kind of absolute prohibition on having children present for court hearings, and certainly in practice I have seen children present at court hearings. So,
under Rule 2B, presence of foster parents, so this particular provision results from some federal legislation, most recently the Safe and Timely Interstate Placement of Foster Children Act of 2006. Prior to that act, the federal law required the state in their state plan to have something that would allow the possibility of foster parents being present in the hearings. The Safe and Timely Interstate Placement of Foster Children Act of 2006 provided that foster parents have a right to be notified of and heard at hearings, and how Wyoming incorporated that provision into our state law was to provide this provision within the juvenile court rules. So both subsection B of this rule and subsection D covers that requirement of the notification of foster parents and then their right to be heard in the hearings. However, there are some parameters on that, and the rule specifically states that the court may limit the presence of the foster parent or care provider to just that time in the hearing when that person's information or testimony is being given, if it is in the best interest of the child or necessary to protect some privacy interests of the parties. So just be aware of that, that foster parents will be at these juvenile hearings, but the court may say, you know, provide the information you want to provide, and then I'm going to ask you to leave the courtroom. The section C of this rule is just providing that information that the general public is excluded from these juvenile court hearings as they are confidential, but the court may allow specific individuals to be present in a hearing if it determines that it's necessary and after giving due consideration to the privacy interests of the parties. And again, subsection D is just that notice that's being provided to the foster parents that the hearings are being held. It doesn't require them to be made a party to the hearing, and I think sometimes that's a confusion on foster parents, is that they may think that they are parties to the proceedings, but they are not under these rules, nor under the Juvenile Court Act, specifically made parties to the proceedings. The next rule is really the big one, I think, in these rules. It's the discovery provisions, and it's where the two cases that we do have from the Supreme Court, those cases have addressed specifically Rule 3 under these rules. And so Beth and I are going to kind of go back and forth in talking about this particular rule. Again, it's relating to discovery, not only discovery provided by the state, but also discovery provided by the respondent parents and discovery of other entities' records, including discovery of the Department of Family Services records. So we just kind of want to go through the particular sections, and then we will talk about the case law that has interpreted this rule. So with respect to the state, it's a rule that basically is self-executing discovery for the state to provide, without the necessity of a request or specific interrogatories or requests for production being made, to provide certain information to the respondent and the guardian ad litem in the case. And there is a requirement that information be provided within 30 days after service of the applicable petition. So in a child protection case, the petition alleging either abuse or neglect, within 30 days after the respondents have been served with that petition, the state is required to provide certain information. That information includes exculpatory information, as well as information relating to the name and address of each person the state intends to call as a witness at the hearing. It includes statements made by the respondent to a state agent, which the state intends to use at the hearing, copies of any written or recorded statements, any written reports or statements made in connection to the case by an expert consulted by the state, and really any document or information which at that point in time the state is aware that they are going to or intend to use at an adjudicatory hearing. It also extends to materials and information in control of members of the prosecutor's staff and of any others who have participated in the investigation or evaluation of the case and who either regularly report or, with reference to the particular case, have reported to the prosecutor's office. And so herein is the first, I think, little inconsistency maybe in the rules, because that is Section 9 of the rule. But when then you go to Section 10 of the rule, that relates specifically to records created or held by the Department of Family Services. Now, I think, again, in certain areas, the affidavit used to support the petition comes from the Department of Family Services, and, of course, that information should be provided, typically will be attached to the petition, but if it's not, it's something that's presented to the state saying, you know, we see the need for an abuse or neglect petition to be filed, and so that information would be included in this self-executing discovery. In some areas of the state, that affidavit a lot of times comes from law enforcement individuals, so again, their reporter information should be provided in this self-executing discovery. However, the department's records as a whole is subject to the provisions under Rule 10, and it requires a specific discovery request, but not to the department. That discovery request under these rules, and only for juvenile proceedings, is to be made to the state, who will then access the department records and determine what information they will provide under that discovery request, or determine whether they are going to object to that discovery request. And the rule provides that the provisions of Wyoming Statute 14.3.214 also still apply to these discovery requests, and of course that is the provision that makes the department's records relating to reports of abuse and neglect confidential. Do you want to?
Yeah, I would say, so a couple of things. I'm fortunate to work in a jurisdiction where this happens pretty naturally as a guardian ad litem or when I acted as a parent's attorney. I have, upon, you know, essentially the district attorney having any of these reports and information, that they are essentially immediately turned over as discovery to the other parties. I would say, though, an item that is typically not provided is name and address of witnesses. That's typically not contained in anything I receive, and so that is kind of an interesting thing that is required in this rule that I'm not sure happens as often as the other types of discovery, such as, you know, reports or statements and those kinds of things are being turned over, I believe. But I would say that I think as a best practice and something that Jill has said that she sees frequently in some other jurisdictions and also agrees it's the best practice is to go ahead and draft a discovery demand under this rule to, you know, as the rule indicates to the state, and be sure that you are listing then in that demand all of these things that this rule provides for you to have. And so if that witness list is something that's, you know, important for you to have, certainly this rule indicates it should be something that's coming to you. So certainly be sure that that's placed into, you know, a demand for discovery and that's sent over to the state, that can just be another best practice to, you know, better represent the child or the parent in the case.
And the rule does talk about compliance by the state and that the state may comply with the rule by advising the respondent and the guardian ad litem in writing or on the record that they may come and inspect the discoverable portions of the state's file at the state's office and to allow that to occur at any time during normal business hours. However, exculpatory information needs to be provided immediately to the parties. I do see a lot of files from around the states, and I did want to throw out a kudo to the Natrona County District Attorney's Office. They have some pretty good forms that they use with respect to the discovery demand, as well as the notice to the parties that pursuant to Rule 3C that the respondents can inspect the discoverable portions of the state's file at any time. And I think in Natrona County that's just an automatic that those documents go out. And when I also say, because the rule also provides that the state can also make discovery of the respondent's information. And so, again, Natrona County District Attorney's Office has a discovery demand which kind of covers all of the information that they're seeking that I think is routinely provided to the parties. But again, understand if you are parents' attorneys that you can get that demand from the state and also are required to respond within 30 days of the discovery demand. The rule does list certain things under Section D that are not subject to discovery, which includes work product, identity of confidential information, and then just a general, any matter that the court determines need not be disclosed. And so if you have particular information that you think should not be disclosed, it would behoove to make a motion to the court to ask at the beginning of the case that information not be subject to the discovery requirements under this rule. The rule under subsection F provides a procedure for discovery and the time frame for discovery, and also talks about the fact that if the discovery is not furnished as required, that a motion to compel discovery may be filed. And give some things that the court can do with respect to if there's a delay or a failure to produce discovery, some options for the court to take. There is also a continuing duty to disclose, so if information comes about during the procedure of the case, and you've already done your initial disclosure, just be aware that you do have that continuing this duty to disclose, and that the disclosure must be in time to permit the beneficial use by the other side of the information. So that's Rule 3. We're now going to talk about the couple of cases that have gone up to the Wyoming Supreme Court where they specifically discuss the rule. And Beth is going to talk about the first one, and then I'll talk about the second one.
Thank you. So, yes, the case I'm going to talk about is a case that I did handle on appeal as an assistant attorney general. What the case is in the interest of MM versus State of Wyoming DFS. The citation for this is 202P3409 for anyone who would like to pull this case up. Essentially, this case, factually, how this these issues under Rule 3 is what was looked at on appeal, there was a case where parents were accused of sexually abusing their young daughter, and so they had counsel, and they requested a trial because they adamantly denied that was what had occurred. And so what had happened, which for those of you who do this line of work, I'm sure you're familiar with the Kemp Center in Denver. And what had happened was at some point during sort of the investigation and leading up to trial in this case, The state's team had done a consultation on the medical aspects of this case and determining whether or not medical experts believed that the child had been abused. There was, you know, a consultation then with doctors at the Kemp Center. All that they were provided, however, was photographs to review, but upon their review of the photographs, they determined that they did not see an injury. Essentially, then what happened was the state had, and we just know this briefly from other parts of the record, where the state had then later argued that that action of going to the Kemp Center and asking for that second opinion was work product, and therefore they were under the impression they did not need to be turning that information over. However, in actuality, what ended up happening is that information was turned over to the parents' attorneys actually prior to trial. Very quickly, I want to say 1 to 2 days before trial, but it was turned over prior to trial, and actually all of that information was then admitted into evidence at the trial, and the jury heard the entire testimony and opinion of that doctor at the Kemp Center that stated from looking at the pictures they did not believe that there was an injury that occurred. However, on appeal, as you would imagine, the issue being that essentially there was not a timely disclosure of actual exculpatory evidence, and therefore it was not or could not have been utilized to the extent it could or should have been at trial. So at this point then on appeal, the court is being asked then to look specifically at Rule 3 and these discovery rules. Essentially, what the court ends up holding and doing through its analysis is that they essentially look at this much more akin to how you would a criminal case, although obviously we all know abuse and neglect cases are not criminal, they are civil and they have a different burden, but essentially it was looked at similar to that, and the court went ahead and looked at this in reference to Brady and in reference to specifically exculpatory evidence, and that although I will say the court did not specifically adopt that the Brady standard was applicable to juvenile actions, they were pretty specific that they weren't going so far as to say that, but however, that was how they were going to go ahead and analyze this situation. Ultimately, under the Brady standard, they found that there was not a discovery violation or a violation of, the concept of turning over exculpatory evidence, and so the case was upheld on appeal. I think specifically they went into the idea that actually particularly where's the harm when the evidence was provided, was utilized at trial, that there just wasn't enough of a showing of any grave harm to the parents' case due to the actions at the district court level with regard to that evidence. However, that it is interesting, although the below there was sort of this argument of work product that was not the argument that was looked at on appeal. And so they looked at it strictly as, okay, let's say this is exculpatory and it needed to be turned over, now what? So they did that analysis rather than an analysis as to work product, because as we just went over, Rule 3 does have a specific exemption for work product, but the court in this case didn't do an analysis to give us much guidance as to whether such a consultation would be considered work product or not.
And just to add, the last part of the rule that we discussed is the timely disclosure, and the court did determine that this was disclosed in time for the parent to make beneficial use of it, given the fact that the recording was actually played for the jury in the case, and I believe they cited to the fact that one or both of the parents referenced the recording both in opening and closing and made arguments with respect to the information. So the second case that was decided in 2013 is In Re MC. It's 299 Pacific 3rd, 75, 2013, Wyoming 43. And again, this case is discussing the application of various parts of Rule 3 within the juvenile court process. This was a case relating to an adjudicatory hearing with a mother who had been alleged to have neglected her children. Just basically the children reported at school that they had accessed a tin that they were aware that was in their mother's room that had marijuana in it, and they took the tin, and the report was that at least one of the children, the younger child, had smoked the marijuana, and actually the report was that the younger child claimed to be, quote, baked at school, suffering from the effects of marijuana. Two different things were alleged, and the mother alleged discovery violations and alleged that her due process rights were violated with respect to the fact, with respect to these discovery violations. The mother, at the day of the hearing, of the adjudicatory hearing, her counsel filed a motion to dismiss, alleging that the state had failed to comply with Rule 3, in that, again, timely did not disclose exculpatory evidence consisting of a negative urinalysis report conducted on the younger child. And then also the mother was claiming that the state failed to provide, as Beth had talked about earlier, a witness list before the hearing, which again violated that provision of Rule 3B3. And so the mother asked the court to dismiss the petition or, in the alternative, to strike the state's witnesses. The juvenile court determined not to dismiss the petition and not to strike the witnesses and allowed the matter to go forward to the adjudicatory hearing, and mother was adjudicated to have neglected the minor children. The issues related to the negative urinalysis, initially the prosecuting attorney was not aware that there had been a negative urinalysis and only discovered that when he met with Department of Family Services employees to prepare them for the adjudicatory hearing. Mother's attorney appeared to be aware that there was a negative urinalysis prior to that instance because she had sent the county attorney's office a letter referencing that negative UA and then had not received it. The court again determined that, well, the guardian ad litem in the case actually pointed out in the argument on the motion to dismiss that the mother's counsel should have filed a motion to compel under the rules. And the Supreme Court determined that, yes, it while the state has obligations under the discovery rules, in effect, the ruling of this case is that you cannot, as the opposing party, sit on your hands and wait for the day of the hearing and then move to dismiss, that you should take advantage of the avenues set out in the rule for compelling that discovery if it has not been provided. The mother did not request a continuance or any additional time to prepare for the adjudicatory hearing, but just simply made the motion to dismiss. The court did, however, I think fairly sternly remind practitioners around the state that the rules are in place, and and I will read the quote, they are called rules for a reason. They are not suggestions or recommendations. They should be followed unless otherwise stipulated or ordered by the trial court. And to me, that was an indication that if further of these cases come up to the Supreme Court where there has been a violation of the rule, they are going to look at strictly applying these rules to the situation. The court did state they could not discern any valid reason that a witness was never provided. The county attorney had argued in the argument on the motion to dismiss is that they had provided all of the discovery and that it would be readily apparent from that information what witnesses and exhibits might be used. But the Supreme Court did not find that to be an appropriate reason as to why the discovery, that particular discovery, the witness and exhibit list, was not provided. The court also talked about Brady in this case, again, not actually saying specifically that Brady applies, but did state that it would be wise for not only the prosecuting attorneys, but also others involved in these proceedings, such as law enforcement officer and Department of Families employees, that they have some obligation to assure that exculpatory evidence is produced. And then the court stated it would be wise for them to assume that the Brady rules may apply in juvenile court proceedings and to make reasonable efforts to identify and provide that kind of evidence to the attorney for the state. So again, I think this case kind of gives some direction to both sides in this action, is that these rules are out there, they should be complied with. If there is a perceived violation of the rule, steps should be taken well before the hearing in the matter to try to seek that discovery, and if you're not able to get it, to file that motion to compel. Again, the court went through the options that the juvenile court had, and in fact, in both of these cases, determined that the court did not abuse their discretion by taking the action that they did. In this case, the action was not to dismiss the case and not to strike the witnesses. The next rule that we want to talk about is Rule 4. It's very brief requirement of submittal of reports, and we know there is language within the Child Protection Act as well as the CHINS Act and the Delinquency Act about the filing of, in particular, MDT reports to the court, but this rule just emphasizes that and provides that those reports need to be provided no later than 5 business days prior to the hearing where any report is to be offered for consideration, that the report shall be filed with the court and a copy of that report provided to all other parties in the case.
So we'll look now at Rule 5. And Rule 5 discusses the right to counsel for parties in juvenile court actions. And this rule, again, as all these rules, it's going to apply not only to abuse neglect cases wherein we're looking at appointment of counsel for parents, typically as the parties who've been accused of the abuse or neglect, but also as to the CHINs or the delinquency cases in which we're looking at appointing counsel to the child that's been accused of being in need of supervision and or potentially some kind of crime in a delinquency situation. And so essentially then the respondent or the whether that's the child or the parent or whomever that is, they are entitled to counsel. Now, that can be appointed to them or it can be a private attorney, certainly. But appointments of counsel can be made and frequently are made in these cases. If we look down at subsection C, it specifically addresses that if you're requesting to have counsel appointed for you, that you do need to obtain a financial affidavit and present that to the court at least 5 days prior to a hearing in order to ensure that there is counsel available and present for you for your hearing. I will say in my specific jurisdiction, I think that this is handled very appropriately. I've never had a situation where a child or a parent who needed counsel went without specifically a child. I've never had a judge go forward on any kind of CHINs or delinquency without an attorney standing right there next to the child. Although I have heard stories from other sources that maybe that doesn't always occur in other parts of the state, unfortunately, but I will say where I practice, that has never happened. Children always have attorneys, and parents who request attorneys are always provided them. I will say, you know, some judges are going to be more stringent on the financial affidavits and more stringent on making their determinations as to whether you can actually afford private counsel. However, again, I've even had cases where the court has determined that they don't meet the threshold that private counsel should be retained, potentially on behalf of a child or something of that nature, and the parents continue to fail to do so, that the court will not allow the child to languish there without an attorney, but will, in fact, go ahead and appoint a public defender to the child to ensure that they are actually represented. So certainly I would say, though, obviously Rule 5 is a very strong rule that I think should be used to ensure that all appropriate respondents do have counsel as they should. And I'll let Jill talk about ICWA a little bit. That is mentioned here.
So subsection B of Rule 5 talks about the right to counsel Native American. And, of course, under the Indian Child Welfare Act, if the Indian Child Welfare Act does apply to a case, ICWA specifically provides that there should be notification to the parents of their right to counsel. But this actually speaks with respect to counsel for the tribes who may come in and intervene in a proceeding. It's stating that the out-of-state attorneys must comply with Rule A, which requires admission pro hac vici, but if it's a case subject to the exclusive jurisdiction of the tribe, which means that the tribe may be asking for the case to be transferred because of that exclusive jurisdiction, the tribe's attorney may appear again for that limited purpose of requesting that transfer of the matter to tribal court without having to go through the requirements that are listed in Rule 5A. In other cases, it provides that the tribe may obtain local counsel to represent them in the proceedings. What I think we see a lot is that a person from the ICWA office of the tribe may appear at hearings, but there's not that many times that the tribes actually appear with counsel, although I have seen it in certain cases.
Thank you. And then as we look to subsection D, it does just have a provision here under Rule 5 to allow a waiver of representation by counsel. However, that must occur in accordance with Statute 76107. As guardian ad litem, I would argue a juvenile would not be able to ever waive, but I don't know. This says it may be allowed. So, and then if we look at Rule 6, this is a real simple provision here that just allows the court to conduct pretrial conferences if needed. I would say that in my practice, that rarely occurs prior to some kind of adjudication hearing. However, that does occur, in juvenile delinquency trials, jury trials, things of that nature. So that's there and available. Rule 7, as to stipulations, this I think is a very important one to go over. What this rule does is it states that it allows, with approval of the court, for parties to stipulate to any matter, including adjudication and disposition. However, it is still required that parties understand what their rights are and that they have an opportunity to consult with counsel before making these kinds of stipulations. But this is, I think, an important provision to think about and is often used specifically, I think, in a preferable way because it kind of goes hand in hand a little bit with Rule 10, which we'll get to, but Rule 10 essentially states that we can't stay our juvenile proceedings because of an ongoing and related criminal proceeding. And so this often occurs if you think about an abuse or neglect case where potentially the issue specific of the abuse potentially was physical, that the alleged offending parent has been also alleged to have committed a crime then of abuse. And so you have a situation where if you're looking to move forward your juvenile case, you can't stop the juvenile case in its tracks just because of the ongoing criminal proceeding. And so what this does is it does allow then a way for the juvenile case to continue under this stipulation wherein a parent doesn't necessarily have to go forward with a full factual basis for the abuse in the juvenile proceeding and thereby potentially self-incriminate in a, criminal proceeding. And so the way I see this in practice is that there will be a stipulation as to adjudication wherein the parent will agree that they go ahead and enter an adjudication of abuse or neglect against them in order to proceed with the juvenile case, but that they do so without providing specific testimony as to the facts that may be underlying that abuse or neglect. And so this is an important rule, I think, for that reason. However, and I think Jill wanted to talk about how we see it used, too, sometimes in a not best practice way.
So while the rule says, again, subject to the approval of the court, parties may stipulate to any matter, including adjudication and disposition, we know that certain hearings, such as shelter care and then now evidentiary permanency hearings, that it may not be appropriate in those instances to do a stipulation. Shelter care requires some pretty specific findings by the court under our statutes. And then again, for those permanency hearings, again, the statute requires some pretty specific information, not only from
the respondent and the state, but also from other players, including the Department of Family Services and perhaps the child in the abuse and neglect cases. And so it may not be best practice to have a stipulation for those particular proceedings. Also in this rule, pay attention if this is an ICWA case that the stipulation is not binding on the parent or Native American custodian unless it is in writing, agreed to in court, which means you actually still have to go to that hearing, whether in person or telephonically, and it needs to be actually signed by the parent or Native American custodian. And then the final thing in this section is that there can be no stipulation entered that contravenes any applicable statute. So I guess I'll throw for an example, I'm going to stipulate to adjudication, but I don't want to pay child support while the child is in care. That would contravene other statutes out there, and so that type of stipulation would not be allowed. And because we're kind of zooming right along, I Beth talked about using this in conjunction with Rule 9 and Rule 10, and what we do see a lot is a stipulation pursuant to Rule 7 and Rule 9. Rule 9 specifically allows for agreements to be made that prohibit the admissibility of certain evidence. But it is the admissibility of certain evidence or the use of certain evidence in other criminal proceedings. And so, for example, if a parent at an MDT provides certain information, the state and the parent's attorney can enter into an agreement that information will not be used in other criminal proceedings. Specifically does not reference use of that information in other types of proceedings, civil proceedings, those type of things. So to be aware of the limitations with respect to Rule 9 and those agreements. And then again, Rule 10, it's very important. I have heard of some areas around the state where juvenile proceedings are being stayed or delayed pending criminal proceedings. This rule is specifically saying that cannot occur and that all proceedings in the juvenile court shall proceed pursuant to the timelines set forth in the various acts in Title 14. So be aware of that the juvenile cases have really short timelines, and there are reasons for that, because we are dealing with families and possibly with children being removed from the home, and so those should not be stayed pending outcome of those if there's a corresponding criminal proceeding. And now Beth is going to talk about Rule 8, and then I think we'll be done with our presentation.
Yes, and Rule 8 is kind of an easy rule. Rule 8 is the CASA provisions, which just specifically allows for court-appointed special advocates to be appointed in our juvenile court actions. I think I speak for all attorneys that we all love CASAs in our cases. They provide, I think, and fill kind of a really important role that as a guardian ad litem, I can only fill to a point, because I have to maintain an attorney-client relationship with the children, and so I really am limited in ways that CASAs are not, and they are able, I believe, to create more of a personal relationship, spend more time with the children in really meaningful ways. And often CASAs provide some of the best information due to them having such a more close or personal relationship with the children. But certainly what this rules outlines is sort of all of their duties. So they have things that they shall do in the cases, such as submitting written reports, but certainly also stating all the things they're allowed to do, such as be present at, you know, MDTs, and to be really made a party to the MDT and be a part of the case. In fact, they even, under these rules, have access to the Department of Family Services records and things of that nature in order to help in the advocation for the children that they represent. And part of what they do is they do ascertain wishes of the child and assist in being sure that everyone knows what the child's wishes are as the cases progress. So for anyone who is part of juvenile cases, definitely look at Rule 8 so you have an idea specifically of what the CASA role is. I think it's an important role, and I think it's important to understand where they fit, what they can and can't do.
And that is the end of our presentation. I don't know how much time
we have a question.
Left.
Yes, okay. We do have a question. First of all, thank you so much, Jill and Beth. This is such a font of knowledge, and I know it's going to be helpful to everyone and to, you know, our cases. The question is from CASA of Natrona County, and it's right on point, Beth. It was regarding Rule 8, Part D, Subsection 5. CASA has access to review and make copies of DFS records. And what are your thoughts on that, and what process should CASA use to go in order to get those copies?
Okay, sure. So I will note also, as a guardian of item, if you look at part of the language there, it's that that they may have access with the consent of the guardian ad litem. So I will say that that is obviously, in my mind, sort of that first step. I think that CASA worker is going to need to contact the guardian ad litem appointed to the case and have a discussion with them about why that they feel that it's important that they have those records. Obviously, also, we need to ensure that that CASA worker has been officially appointed in the case. And in my opinion, as a guardian ad litem, that means I have an actual court order which has been filed with the court and signed by the judge that appoints them in the case. So so that's another important hurdle that has to be met first. But in the event that the guardian ad litem is going to consent to the records, then obviously contact would need to be made to the Department of Family Services to request that. I would say, just for peace of mind, I think in my mind that I don't know that it is specifically in this rule, which is where then those copies are maintained and held by the CASA worker would be of some concern in my mind. And so I would hope that CASA would have internal rules and policies which would require those to only be maintained somewhere in a secure setting, such as the CASA office itself in a locked file cabinet, something of that nature. Certainly, in my mind, would be a best practice because for obvious reasons, these are confidential records, and we wouldn't want just anyone to have access to them. But certainly, CASAs are seen as, you know, having a very important role, and so they're given such important information as what could be maintained in the DFS records.
Okay. Well, thank you, Beth. And I don't know, Edie, if there are anyone called in with a comment. We don't have we just have a response from CASA of Natrona County. We're just about out of time. We have 2 minutes, but they said, I mean more from DFS standpoint. Once we have discussed it with the GAO, we're told the AG's office won't allow the local office to give us copies regarding DFS policy 1.2. And maybe this can be resolved offline, folks, because we are just about running out of time, unless you've got a 30-second answer to this, Jill.
Well, you know, obviously, Anne, if I give advice to my client, I can't discuss it. So.
Okay. But this is something that we at CJP will be following up on CASA of Natrona County, just to get everybody on the same page. Oh, she's going to email you, Jill, so thank you.
Okay, that'll work.
Okay. And we've got 1 minute, Edie. Any sign-offs from our coordinator?
No, just thank you to everybody that's tuned in today, and we'll go ahead and end the broadcast. So tune in next month for our next Blog Talk Radio episode.
And thank you again, Edie and Jill and Beth, for this very informative program, and I hope it was been...